Chapter 20. Wildlife abounds. Midway through 1967, I received an unexpected invitation from my father, asking me to visit him and his second wife, now living in Nairobi, for the Christmas holidays. The time frame fitted perfectly with the 6-week National Art School Christmas break, and I was over the moon excited. As I was already a seasoned traveler, this invitation offered me yet another opportunity to broaden my horizons, this time in Africa. My father and Alison had left New Zealand to take up the job of a lifetime with United Nations in Kenya. They had settled into their new life in East Africa and were now ready to receive family. By way of background, my parents separated in 1957, followed by a messy divorce. As a result, I'd not lived under my father's roof for 10 years, and as my departure date drew nearer, I experienced intensifying waves of both excitement and trepidation. After my parents divorced, my father remarried, this time to family friend Alison McRae, the daughter of well-known Sydney architect George McRae. Thereafter, my mother, who was an unforgiving woman, would, given any opportunity, voice her malevolent feelings toward Alison, criticizing her looks, her figure, her taste and her lack of style. But she chose to conveniently disregard her attributes, which included an analytical intellect, as she was one of the few women to graduate in science from Sydney University before World War II, and her orderly scientific mind. I'd lived with my mother's ceaseless criticism of Alison for years, and as a result, my attitude towards her was somewhat jaundiced. Because of this, I did wonder how my visit would pan out. Living under the same roof 24/7, over 6 weeks, could be a colossal test of tolerance for three people, who were in effect, total strangers. My father was an electrical engineer who trained at Faraday House Electrical Engineering College in London, and was now working for the United Nations International Labour Organization. For many years, he had worked for W.D. Scott & Company, a firm of highly regarded Sydney-based management consultants. He'd spent some time living and working in Auckland, helping to streamline New Zealand's plywood industry. I was told he'd been headhunted for the International Labour Organization job, and assumed that the success of the plywood project had come to the attention of the International Labour Organization recruiters. My father's Nairobi brief was completely different. He was to set up a small business advisory center, offering business advice and training for Africans, struggling to compete with Asian, reed people from India, traders, who dominated commerce across East Africa at the time. The job came with numerous benefits, including one dependent's airfare once a year to wherever he was posted. His United Nations appointment was the high point of his long career. At last, at 59 years old, he had the professional status and the salary he craved. At the end of 1960, my mother and I left Australia for New Guinea. Since then, I'd only seen my father twice. The first time in 1961 at my brother's wedding to a Sydney socialite, the second in 1965 during my last week at the Glenie Memorial School in Toowoomba. He had come to discuss my disappointing scholastic results with the headmistress, after which, she immediately called a full school assembly, and resigned. My father cheekily took the credit for this extraordinary turn of events, even though he claimed that, during his one-hour meeting with her, he couldn't get a word in edgeways. Naturally, my mother was incensed by his audacity. But I digress. I'd had a total of 4 months to prepare for this grand African adventure. By departure day, I had a freshly minted passport, a vaccination booklet itemizing each of the immunizations I'd received, stylish home-sewn garments including the little black dress for cocktail parties, a hairpiece, my mother's Kodak camera, and a number of carefully wrapped Christmas gifts for my father and Alison. I was super excited, wondering what adventures awaited me on the other side of the Indian Ocean. To get there, I took a Qantas flight out of Sydney to Perth, and then across the ocean to Mauritius. Those of us traveling on to Nairobi or London knew we'd be spending a couple of days on Mauritius, whilst waiting for the BOAC connecting flight from London. Fortunately, the expenses associated with this two-day layover were covered by Qantas, and I must confess, I was looking forward to making the most of the amenities on offer at the posh seaside resort where we'd stay, whilst waiting for the connecting flight. My short stay on the island was an interesting experience, as once again, I found myself an uninvited guest in yet another multiracial country. Here in Mauritius, the most unexpectedly arresting visual element was the profusion of sugarcane. Every which way, there were expansive vistas of bright green. Tall, feather-tipped cane, waving gently in the breeze. The cane planted right up to the edge of the road on both sides, creating long, straight, corridors of road, open to the sky. We filled our days being tourists. We drove through the seemingly endless sugarcane fields to visit sites of interest recommended by the resort staff. As we explored the island, I was fascinated by the numerous religious shrines, both Hindu and Christian, nestled into the greenery by the sides of the roads. Each one lovingly erected and decorated by the devout. I must confess that we were all thoroughly enjoying the resort, with its uninterrupted views across the Indian Ocean, as we chowed down on the abundant fresh seafood the surrounding ocean provided, magnificently presented at every meal. But all too soon, it was time to leave this tropical island paradise, to board the aircraft for the last leg of my journey to Nairobi, to holiday with my father and Alison, who no doubt, like me, were harboring niggling concerns about the success or otherwise of my visit. They were at the Nairobi airport to meet me. We then drove to their picturesque ranch-style bungalow, set squarely at the end of an extensive paved driveway, amid lawns and well-kept gardens, in the quiet leafy suburb of Lavington, an enclave of the well-to-do. Their two-acre estancia was fastidiously maintained both inside and out, by two Kikuyu men, Bulla, the gardener, and Mariba, the cook and house servant, both of whom lived on the premises. Alison had already applied her forensic mind to learning Swahili, the lingua franca of East Africa. She was determined to master the language, necessary to manage the servants and ensure the household ran smoothly. For the first time in her adult life, Alison, who married my father in her late 40s, wasn't working as a scientist to support herself, or as was later the case, to support my mother and myself. A clever, active woman, she'd quickly became involved with several local charitable organizations, and, as my father proudly put it, she now worked for charity. During business hours Monday to Friday, my father was at the Small Business Development Center office, so Alison was left with the task of entertaining me. She took me on whatever outings were scheduled for a given day. Once a week, I accompanied her to the Nairobi General Hospital's maternity ward, to rearrange flowers for European mothers, who had recently given birth. This wasn't madly exciting for a 19-year-old, but I did my best not to let it show. As an aside, a week or so later, I was unexpectedly admitted to the same hospital, to have my wisdom teeth extracted. But, back to the story. Late one afternoon, during my first week in Kenya, Alison suggested we visit the Nairobi National Park, Kenya's main tourist draw card, due to its proximity to the city. In less than half an hour, we reached the city's southern outskirts. Once through the entrance gates, we saw a profusion of African animals roaming free across 12,000 hectares of thorn tree-studded grassland. As a child, I'd been taken to visit Sydney's Taronga Zoo, and I recall being super distressed to see so many wild animals confined in small spaces. Here in the Nairobi National Park, the tables were turned. We humans were the ones confined to our vehicles, and instructed to keep the windows and doors closed for the duration of our visit. That afternoon, we found a space to park the car, with a ringside view down into a sizable waterhole, one of a number in the park. From this vantage point, we could clearly see the long lines of wildlife, wandering in from all directions to drink. Our car was one of a number filled with humans, watching intently, as the animals meandered between our cars, to access the waterhole. Lions, zebra, varieties of gazelle, baboon, monkey and giraffe took turns to drink, completely unperturbed by the squawking birds that swooped in and out amongst them. This was the first time I'd been up close with African wildlife, and as the temperature dropped, I was fascinated to watch the playful antics of the animals after they'd drunk their fill. I was hooked. Visits to the national park were the highlight of my early days in Nairobi. Whenever Alison suggested a late afternoon visit, I jumped at the chance, because as the newbie I couldn't get enough of wildlife watching. Our regular visits gave me the opportunity to identify many African animals, both large and small, making their home in this extensive area of bushland that had been intentionally set aside for wildlife preservation and only a stone's throw from the city. But I knew my father and Alison had other interesting excursions planned for the remainder of my stay. Naturally, I was intensely curious to know what, where and when. Thankfully, I didn't have to wait for too long to find out. On reflection. Visiting my father in Nairobi. My father had invited me to re-enter his life, after a gap of 10 years. During those years, I had seen him twice. But since enrolling at the National Art School, I'd been living independently, so I found it a tad tricky to fit back into a tight domestic routine that was unfamiliar and offered little wriggle room. With effort, I managed to conceal my know-it-all teenage attitude. Also, I was harboring a sizable load of second-hand resentment, thanks to my mother's never-ending flow of vitriol, whenever my father and Alison's names were mentioned in conversation. Now under their roof, I watched with fascination as Alison deftly managed my father, particularly when she had a good idea. In a moment of conspiratorial openness, she explained her modus operandi for implementing her ideas. Firstly, she would plant the seed by briefly outlining her idea, then bide her time, waiting for my father to later claim the idea as his own. I realized this was an example of manipulation elevated to the level of high art, and in marked contrast to the confrontational interactions I remember my parents having before my father left us. In these confrontations, my mother rarely got her own way, and always resented it. Having witnessed both coexistence methods, I was determined to find another way to coexist in my own personal relationships. Instead of manipulation or confrontation, I tried consultation, and it worked perfectly. When I reflect on my subsequent relationships, I was nearly always the initiator of change. I would lead with the question, "What do you think of this idea?" As a result, most of my ideas came to fruition. I've now lived alone for many years, and as a result, the decision-making process is far simpler. Nonetheless, consultation is still necessary, particularly when I'm out of my depth and need advice. The Nairobi National Park. Following my numerous visits to the Nairobi National Park, I've not been able to bring myself to visit a traditional zoo in any of the many countries I've since lived in or visited. After seeing a lioness lying on the roof of a vehicle, with one paw dangling down over the windscreen, my perspective on wildlife management changed forever. All these years later, I have come to realize what an extraordinary privilege it was for me to make multiple visits to this incredible facility, unlike the package tour tourists who got to visit once. Living in Nairobi, we visited often, fascinated to watch the passing parade of wildlife at close quarters. Wildlife that had no fear of vehicles or people. Had it not been for my father and Alison choosing to live in Nairobi, this close-up access to the plethora of wildlife inhabiting the park would not have been possible. Impressions of Africa. My first impressions of the people, the wildlife and the landscape of Africa was awe-inspiring. But it wasn't until years later that I came to fully appreciate the gift my father and Alison had given by inviting me to visit them in Nairobi, not just once, but twice. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Facts. George McCrae. Alison McCrae Granger's father was a Scottish architect who migrated to Australia to become the government architect of New South Wales. He went on to design some of Sydney's best-known buildings, including completion of the Sydney Town Hall, the Queen Victoria Building, and the lower entrance to Taronga Zoo. Mauritius. Mauritius is an island of strategic importance. It was uninhabited until the Dutch took possession in 1594, eager to harvest the ebony timber and grow sugar cane. The settlement was later abandoned. The French came next, in 1715, then the British, in 1810. The island became Britain's main sugar-producing colony until independence was granted, in 1967. Nairobi. The capital of Kenya is situated in the south-central part of the country, at an elevation of 1,600 meters, with a population of 10 million in 1967, that has since increased to 57 million, in 2024. With an annual rainfall of 926 millimeters. Faraday House Electrical Engineering College was referred to as a facility providing engineering training for the Sons of Gentlemen, operated between 1890 and 1967. The four-year course resulted in a DFH, Diploma of Faraday House. My father attended this institution in the early 1930s, and the qualification stood him in good stead as he moved into management consultancy for many years, before joining the International Labour Organization. Swahili. Swahili is a Bantu language, spoken by an estimated 150 million people in most East African countries. Swahili is officially recognized as the lingua franca of the East African community. Nairobi National Park. Nairobi is promoted as the world's only wildlife capital. The national park is located about 7 kilometers south of Nairobi's central business district. It is fenced on three sides, with the southern boundary left open, to allow migrating wildlife to move between the park and the adjacent Katangala Plains. The park's wide-open grass plains, scattered with thorn trees, hosts a wide variety of wildlife, including the endangered black rhino, lions, leopards, cheetahs, hyenas, buffaloes, giraffes and diverse birdlife, with over 400 species recorded. Herbivores gather in the park during the dry season. African thorn trees. Vachellia tortilis, widely known as Acacia tortilis but now attributed to the genus Vachellia, grow across Africa. In extremely arid conditions it may grow as a small wiry bush, but in other regions, with a higher rainfall, the tree can grow to a height of 21 meters.